Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dennis Halliday, former Under Secretary General at the United Nations and coordinator of Iraq's Oil for Food program, who assesses the U.S. war and the humanitarian crisis it has produced. American citizen Tom Cahill and John Richardson from the UK, who explain why they have decided to remain in Baghdad as human shields, protecting civil infrastructure and to minimize civilian casualties. And John MacArthur, publisher of Harper's Magazine, who critically examines the U.S. media's coverage of the war in Iraq. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Angry over the U.S.-led attack on Iraq, anti-war campaigners across the globe are mobilizing a boycott of American corporations. In the past 2 years, Arab consumers have shunned big names like McDonald's and Coca-Cola in support of Palestinians. Now anti-war forces in Europe are targeting big American companies that gave lots of cash to George W. Bush's presidential campaign. The Belgian group For Mother Earth is leading a boycott of U.S. financial giant MBNA, which contributed $3 million to Bush's 2000 campaign. Another major boycott target is software king Microsoft. According to the BBC, calls for boycotts of American products come from nations as diverse as Argentina, France, India, Indonesia, Japan, and Pakistan. Patricia McKenna, a member of the European Parliament, is one of the few politicians to endorse the anti-American government boycott. She insisted, governments are ignoring their own people, so the only thing they have left at this stage is to boycott companies that are clearly going to make a profit from this war. Many boycotters are not just upset about the Iraq war, but with the Bush administration's opposition and non-participation in many international treaties, such as accords on global warming, banning landmines, and establishment of the International Criminal Court. The Guardian newspaper reports that hundreds of South African AIDS activists stormed several police stations in mid-March during mass protests against President Thabo Mbeki for his refusal to offer advanced treatment for people with HIV. The activists marched to the police station in Sharpeville, the town where 69 anti-apartheid activists were killed in 1960, and in Cape Town and Durban. Organized by the Treatment Action Center, the activists blamed the government's health minister for denying antiretroviral drugs to state hospitals and clinics, and Trade Minister Alec Irwin for blocking the production of AIDS drugs in South Africa. So far, the government has refused to authorize the use of drugs and instead relies on traditional remedies like garlic, onion, olive oil, and other herbs to boost the immune system. Meanwhile, 600 Africans die every day from AIDS-related diseases. During the day of protest, police officials were given a people's docket demanding the immediate investigation of the thousands of people who have died of AIDS and AIDS-related illnesses. Activists say these deaths could have been prevented with AIDS drugs, and the mass action campaign has won the backing of doctors, clergy, trade unions, and gay and lesbian groups. Meanwhile, government officials like Finance Minister Trevor Manuel continues to dismiss the use of antiretroviral AIDS treatment, labeling them a lot of voodoo. Brazil's militant landless movement of poor peasants, known as MST, is not giving new left-leaning president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva any slack. After a two-month truce, MST is reviving its 20-year campaign of seizing land and turning it over to peasants. In coming weeks, more land seizures are promised in five Brazilian states. In January, Lula announced that the government would expropriate 200,000 hectares of unproductive land for redistribution. MST says this is only a fraction of the land redistribution that is needed. According to the New Internationalist magazine, MST was founded in the early 1980s in southern Brazil after tens of thousands of small farmers were driven off their land. Through the years, MST has set up 1,000 settlements where 100,000 people live and farm. MST spokesman Jamie Amarin says, "We need far more land reform on a far greater scale. Brazil has at least 4 million landless families." Yet Lula's options are limited by the pressures to sell cash crops like soy on the international market to raise dollars to pay off Brazil's huge debt. In the meantime, MST activists will continue to seize land, often in the face of police harassment, with their famous slogan, "Occupy, Resist, Produce." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
as U.S. and British soldiers fight for control of southern Iraq on their way toward a crucial battle in Baghdad, civilians in large cities like Basra and smaller towns are confronting severe shortages of water, food, and medicine. But with the American military insisting that they alone will control the distribution of aid, international relief organizations are reluctant to participate, not wanting to be identified with a U.S. invasion viewed by many as illegal and launched without U.N. Security Council authorization. The fact that much of the territory now occupied by U.S. forces remains unsecure makes the distribution of supplies by the Pentagon itself that much more difficult and chaotic. Aid agencies from around the world have demanded that President Bush place the humanitarian relief effort under the supervision of United Nations agencies and personnel with many years of experience in Iraq. With an eye toward post-war administration of Iraq, the Security Council recently voted to transfer control of Iraq's oil for food program to UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dennis Halliday, a former Undersecretary General at the UN who administered Iraq's oil for food program before he resigned in protest against economic sanctions in 1998. Halliday discusses the current humanitarian crisis confronting the people of Iraq and the legal obligation of the American and British invasion force to provide immediate aid to the desperate and frightened population under their control.
Well, for me, this war is, of course, unnecessary. It constitutes blatant aggression by the United States and Britain outside the bounds of the United Nations without any resolution under Chapter 7 of the Charter in support. I mean, it's an extraordinary adventure for two permanent members of the Security Council to attempt to take a war in complete breach of the Charter, international law, and without the support of the vast, vast majority of member states of the organization. And for me, of course, the crisis now is that it to be stopped, if possible, and end the humanitarian catastrophe in the making. Failing that at least those responsible, and that is Britain and the United States, respond to their obligations under the Geneva Conventions and meet the needs, water, food, and other needs of the Iraqi people in their area of control.
Dennis Halliday, could you give an assessment for us of the humanitarian crisis that the Iraqi people are now faced with in about a week of the conflict?
Yes. When I was in Baghdad in January to February also, the government had distributed 3 or 4 months of its basic food supplies. That's, you know, wheat, rice, flour, cooking oil, sugar, tea, all the very minimal but basic needs of the family, including powdered cream milk, full cream milk, and cheese. I think what's probably happened is some families, the poorer families, have sold some of these produce in order to buy fresh vegetables, meat, chicken, eggs, fruit. Because there seems to be some shortage now of food, we understand at least, in Basra, in the south of the country, although they also receive these supplies. And I think I understand from the Minister of Trade a few days ago that they're actually still trying to send food to the people in Basra. The immediate crisis, however, other than food, which is a matter of weeks, perhaps, but the immediate problem is water. Iraq is one of these countries that does not have natural potable water supplies. It needs to be treated. It needs to be distributed. That requires, of course, a system, an infrastructure, but also electric power. And when these systems collapse in times of hostilities, whether it's deliberate or not deliberate, the consequence for the children in particular is catastrophic. As UNICEF was telling us just recently, you know, in the south of Iraq, 25%+ of children under 5 are already malnourished. When you're malnourished at that age and you get unclean water, just simple diarrhea is enough to take your life. And, of course, dysentery or other more serious problems, waterborne disease, is an absolute killer. So that, I think, is the absolute immediate crisis that several millions, obviously, are facing in Umm Qasr or Nasri or Basra or Najaf or Karbala, these towns in the south of Baghdad.
Could you summarize for our listeners what international law says and the Geneva Convention states about the responsibilities of invading forces such as the United States and the United Kingdom at this moment when increasing numbers of Iraqi citizens are falling under their control in occupied zones of their own country?
Well, the Geneva Conventions are quite specific. They establish that the responsibility for the humanitarian care of the civilians and, of course, those who surrender, military types who surrender, fall squarely on the shoulders of those in aggression, in the combatants, in this case the United States and Britain. And that, of course, presents a huge challenge to the United States in the south of Iraq today. given the difficulties we've described with regard to water, and the violence of the response, and the difficulty of bringing in food and water to people under these hostile conditions. But the responsibility is there. And this responsibility, in fact, goes way beyond the hostilities per se. I understand, I think it's the Fourth Protocol, says that this obligation extends up to 1 year. And therefore, for the United States to find other sources of funding, although, of course, any part of the so-called coalition, I guess, is willing to put in some money, is really negligent of its budgetary and other responsibilities in this connection.
Do you see any sign that the United States and Britain are taking seriously and making food distribution, medicine, and water a high priority in this war?
No. Very sad to say, despite the television coverage, what I'm seeing is propaganda. A lot of hoopla about bringing in one ship into Umm Qasr. It wasn't an orderly system. It looked like more like looting to me. But nevertheless, it was a distribution from the back of a truck to aggressive young men who came out of these places to look for food and take the packets and take the water. But that does not guarantee that the food gets to orphans, to single mothers, to families. This is a humiliation, in my view, of the Iraqi people who are being forced to beg, in a sense, in their own country under these terrible conditions imposed upon them by the United States and Britain. I mean, it's a tragic. To watch it, I find it absolutely awful, and it must humiliate not just the Arabs in Iraq, but throughout the entire community.
Dennis Halliday, there seems to be a palpable fear that terrorists will strike in reaction to the U.S. war against Iraq. The Bush administration, on the contrary, basically says that this war in Iraq will make the United States safer. But, of course, there are others who say that this inflames an already desperate hatred of the United States and its policy, particularly in the Middle East, particularly around Israel, and now with this war in Iraq. Do you think in the end the Bush administration will be vindicated in executing this war to make America a safer place?
No, of course, I don't see it that way. I mean, in my view, the preemptive strike that was 9/11 in New York was the beginning of a process. And to respond with the sort of violence that Mr. Bush responded in Afghanistan, and now very falsely, in my view, linking al-Qaeda to Iraq and now with the Iraq war, is, of course, exactly the wrong way to go about it. This is a guarantee of recruitment of many into terrorist organizations, if that's the way it works, al-Qaeda or others. It's exactly the way to maintain the frustration and the anger and the poverty and the neglect and interference that so upsets the Arab community, as represented by the people who think like bin Laden. And, of course, most Arabs do not, happily. But that sort of thinking, which is very comparable to Mr. Bush himself, you know, good and evil, black and white, a very simplistic sort of messianic way of going about things, I think it's terribly dangerous. And I think we're helping, sadly, the process of more terrorist involvement, because we are perpetuating the presence of our Christian Western ideals, our corruption of their culture and Islamic values in the Middle East. And, you know, what on earth are we doing there? Haven't we learned from the colonial past of this part of the world that we have no competence and no place in the Middle East?
That was Dennis Halliday, former Undersecretary General at the UN. To get more information on the international campaign to protect Iraq's long-suffering civilian population, call Voices in the Wilderness at area code 773-784-8065 or visit their website at www.vitw.org. As the relentless U.S. bombing over Baghdad continues, it is becoming increasingly difficult to contact those who remain in the city due to telephone towers and other communication equipment being destroyed. Between the Lines recently reached several international volunteers by phone who traveled to Baghdad to act as human shields, protecting civilian infrastructure. Your reporter Denise Manzari files this report. Tom Cahill is a 66-year-old American from Fort Bragg, California. A retired photographer and journalist, he has placed himself, along with 13 others from 8 different countries, as a human shield at the April 7th water treatment plant located 10 miles northwest of downtown Baghdad. As the coalition attacks intensify, Cahill describes the experience.
Well, it keeps us up at night, but then we catch sleep whenever we can. They're pretty much bombing around the clock, and all around us, the south. Most recently, they were bombing in the west, and there's fires. We can see the smoke from fires along the skyline, along the Tigris River here. Sometimes the missiles or bombs are very close, and it shakes the building and rattles the windows. Sometimes the sound and the shockwave hurts our ears. Sometimes we even hear the bombs or missiles going overhead. There's sort of a swishing, whistling sound.
Cahill believes by placing himself in harm's way, he and others will minimize civilian casualties.
I came here to make the loudest statement possible in opposition to my government's attempt to dominate the world. And now that I'm here, I'm trying to help keep the civilian casualties at a minimum. And I think the SHIELDS, together with world opinion, are doing that. I think the U.S. military is in chaos right now, fighting a war of public relations. I think they're very upset that it's an urban guerrilla war, their worst nightmare. And anybody with any sense would know that that type of warfare is going to be very high casualties on both sides, especially high civilian casualties. So far, the U.S. and the Brits have been taking desert. When you send a tank into a city during daytime or any time, it's a sitting duck for the urban guerrillas. One of the reasons I came over here is because I'm so angry. And now we hear that we American SHIELDS who survive this and return home face up to 12 years in prison, $10,000 fine, and we may be tried in military courts. Thank you, Mr. President, for motivating us even stronger.
John Richardson is a psychologist from West Yorkshire, Great Britain, and has also been at the April 7th water treatment plant in Baghdad since mid-February.
In general, the Iraqi people are, I mean, the words I would describe myself at the moment are steadfast, and they are dignified, even in the case of very heavy bombardment, which we've seen ourselves in the last week, and we've experienced. We've experienced some near misses, but as we see the children and the families in the village, they always give us the two-finger salute of peace, and then they put their hands to their heart, and they look up at the sky as though, well, for many of them, this is Allah. Whatever Allah wants will be, in a sense. But this has very much been a feature, you know, of the Iraqi people. You know, nobody has ever panicked and started running, and they still look upon it, even though they often don't know we're human SHIELDS, we are just Westerners. There's never been any aggression towards us at all.
Almost 70 others have placed themselves at electrical power plants, a food storage plant, and an oil refinery, which was almost hit by Allied bombing. And many say they will remain in Baghdad, even if it means the loss of their own life. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari. In the months leading up to the U.S. war in Iraq, America's corporate media outlets provided intensive coverage of President Bush's failed campaign to win international support for invasion. But with what many critics characterize as a lack of scrutiny of the administration's justification and motivation. While U.S. allies around the world rejected White House evidence of Iraqi covert weapons programs as exaggerated or bogus, America's press corps dutifully reported government pronouncements asking very few tough questions. Since the war was launched and branded Operation Iraqi Freedom by the Pentagon, corporate television networks have featured unprecedented live reports from the front lines using the latest video satellite technology. Unlike the first Persian Gulf War 12 years ago, the Pentagon has allowed reporters to accompany U.S. troops in the field of battle by embedding them with specific combat units, while subjecting their dispatches to military censorship. But as American soldiers encountered stiffer resistance than expected, and U.S. bombs and troops killed and injured a growing number of Iraqi civilians, much of the press continued to cheerlead for the Pentagon and minimize critical reporting. John MacArthur reviewed the U.S. media's conduct during the 1991 war with Iraq in his book titled Second Front, Censorship and Propaganda in the Gulf War, which described how the White House easily manipulated public opinion through the use of propaganda and with the eager collaboration of a compliant press corps. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with MacArthur, publisher of Harper's Magazine, who assesses the performance of U.S. corporate media in covering America's ongoing war in Iraq.
95% of the reporting, so-called, is trucks and tanks moving around and infantry marching and artillery being loaded, boxes being loaded and unloaded, and smart bombs hitting their targets perfectly. And long, long stretches of speculation by uninformed military and civilian analysts. And it's also still very patriotic, very pro-military, and very biased in favor of the official line. If you look at most of the datelines in newspapers, they are still a Kuwait and Qatar, which means that the reporters are writing their stories based on briefings by military PR men who obviously have an agenda to push.
Can a reporter be embedded, so to speak, with the troops and not compromise objectivity?
Only if they're extraordinarily independent and they keep in mind that their first loyalty should be to the Constitution, not to the army or the temporary government in Washington. But this is a very hard thing for most reporters to do. They're not geniuses. They're influenced by emotion, fear. They feel very dependent on the soldiers for their safety. They're some of them grateful to be there at all. So they feel they owe the military something when in fact they owe them nothing. The people they owe are the people, or, you know, the citizens that they're supposed to be informing. By accident, some good reporting is happening, and the overall impression that the military campaign is going poorly has come through loud and clear, in spite of all the junk on CNN and on Fox. People realize that it's not going easily. The Iraqis are fighting back, and it will be no cakewalk, and that in and of itself is a good thing, and it is progress in terms of overall war reporting.
What about the kind of overt censorship of voices of dissent that we've seen in the media? Certainly Peter Arnett was roundly punished in the first Persian Gulf War, recently fired for comments he made on Iraqi state television. But you also have talk show hosts like Phil Donahue, recently fired from MSNBC. Internal memo suggested partly was because of his anti-war stance.
Oh, yeah. The heat is on. If you're against the war, if you're against the party line, if you're against the government on this crazy war, and it is absolutely crazy what they're doing, self-defeating also. It's crazy in a self-defeating way. If you say these things and you're in the media, you're marked for destruction, or you're marked for attack anyway. Now, I'm not vulnerable, and my editor and writers aren't vulnerable because, in effect, I own the magazine. I own Harper's Magazine. I mean, it's a nonprofit foundation, but I might as well own it. So we're not threatened by it. But if you're an ordinary reporter or editor and you think there's something wrong with this policy or the way the war is being prosecuted, or you're just unhappy that to see people getting killed, and you say so, you're in trouble. You're in trouble. You're marked as a troublemaker and somebody who's not going along to get along.
What kind of questions should the press be asking at this moment when we're in the second week of this war? What are the questions that the reporters seem to be avoiding?
Well, I would be asking everybody at every opportunity about the possibilities of the American Army or the CIA planting evidence to make it look like the Iraqis had chemical weapons. They desperately need to find some kind of proof, some kind of evidence that the invasion was justified and that the UN had in fact failed, because when all is said and done, you know, when it's over, I don't know how bloody it's going to be, but it's going to be somewhat bloody. A lot of people are going to ask, even pro-war types are going to ask, was it worth it? And they're going to need evidence that the Iraqis were storing up the things that they said they weren't storing. So I'm going to ask Hans Blix whether he thinks that, first of all, chemical weapons can be planted, so to speak, and whether the UN inspectors can figure out that they've been planted when they go back in, or if they go back in after the war. I'd also like to know about what the rules of engagement are for American combat troops, because Army bureaucrats write everything down, and they probably have told the soldiers what they are supposed to do and what they're not supposed to do when they encounter civilians, when they encounter enemy fire. I would like to know what the specifics are. I don't think there's been much on that in the press.
And just one final question, John MacArthur, and that is, it seems that the growing peace movement here in this country and internationally is focusing more attention on the role that the media plays in shaping public opinion. We've had a number of demonstrations at CNN headquarters in Atlanta and recent demonstrations at the headquarters of television networks in New York City at Rockefeller Center. Do you see this as something that has a possibility of changing how the media interacts with the public and provides information in a non-propagandistic way?
Well, yes, I see it as a positive development, because people are waking up to the notion that the big television networks, and actually some of the big newspapers, are effectively part of the government propaganda machine. The New York Times, all by itself, helped start this aluminum tube scare back on September 7th of 2002. It's a leak to them by the White House, and turned into a major scare story, which, of course, has been completely refuted by Mohammed Al-Baradei, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency. And Fox News, on the other extreme, is just a full-time propaganda outlet for the government. And remember that the networks are operating at the sufferance of the American people. We own the public airwaves, not the cable. I'm not talking about cable. I'm just talking about broadcast. So they have a responsibility to the American people to be somewhat more fair, and we have a responsibility to hold them accountable. So I like this trend, and I'm hoping the demonstrations will expand to the New York Times and the Washington Post.
That was John MacArthur, publisher of Harper's Magazine and author of the book Second Front, Censorship and Propaganda in the Gulf War, published by University of California Press. Visit Harper's Magazine's website at www.harpers.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Sasha Summer-Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Vanzari.